It's been
She-wolves out there, and you know today is Freya's day in the bunker right here in north central Indiana with Terrible Tommy. And on Fridays, we always try to play a love song out there. Conway Twitty got started in the 50s. He was an interesting name, but it worked out good for him because you can't forget a name like that. But Conway hit the top of the charts back in the late 50s, and I forget which one of these songs it was, but anyhow, he did. And then he kept singing, but his popular appeal started to drop a little bit, you know. He never dropped in the countryside, so he went back into the countryside and sang basically country for the rest of his career and made quite a fortune doing it. Conway Twitty. I remember I was driving back from Louisiana with two or three of my boys way back there in the 70s. I think it was the 70s. And we got word on the radio that Conway Twitty had died. And boy, I'm telling you, from then on out, from Louisiana all the way to Southern California, every country western station and many of the regular stations were having all these women call in and crying. He was sort of like the Dean Martin of the country set, Conway Twitty. Well, it's a beautiful day here in the Midwest in north central Indiana on August the 1st. What a great way to start off August. Yeah, we're getting the great weather this summer around here. I'm telling you, I don't think I've seen any better weather here than I have in years past, having been born and raised for several years right here in Indiana. I'm telling you, this is terrific weather. So, hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your August dues. Your August donations are due for the radio show. We're going to send you out 6 one-hour shows this week. And keep you so busy. I know a lot of you guys don't get a chance to listen to every one of them, and you stack them up and then sometimes take a whole day to listen to back shows. So anyhow, we try to keep them coming because we want to keep the mostly news for racial separatists and those kind of people. We like to keep that news going to you. And I find out many times that I'm 24 hours, sometimes 48 hours ahead of the regular news broadcasters on some of these stories. I don't know whether you've noticed that. Well, anyhow, it's a great day, and we're ready to go here, and let's get at it, man. I got a real nice letter here from POW David Tate, the youngest member of the Order Brutus Wagon, Robert J. Matthews' jolly men. And he's in prison down here in southeast Missouri, and Charleston, Missouri, which is not an awful ways for me, and I want to get over there and visit him one of these days. But he sent along a little article here, and I told him I'd read it to you, and I think he's got it pretty well figured out here. The title of it is Idiots, Agents, Provocateur, and the Jews Media by David Tate. A young brother, new to the movements, commented on some Klansman he saw in the Jews media generally making a fool of himself and all of us while making pointless comments like, quote, I don't need a reason to hate niggers, I hate them because they breathe, unquote. This led to a lengthy discussion about morons, zealots, infiltrators, con men, Asian provocateurs, and informers. Read the last one, liars. It would be nice if we could put a limiter or pressure valve on all the statements made by anyone among the various so-called movements. You know, Dennis Mahan refers to that right wing as a bowel movement. That's my comment, not David Tate's. But such statements made by anyone among the various movements, but such pleasures only exist among a structured and organized movement singular. Well, and that's only if you've got the muscle to keep them in line. And are impossible among a mixed, broken, disenfranchised, and completely confused nation suppressed under an Orwellian system of control which presents lies as truth and fact and villainizes truth-tellers. Our first problem is that extremism and fringe groups attract strays who don't fit in anywhere else, right along with the frustrated and well-meaning masses of whites who are uneducated as to the politics, history, and religion of our folk, and who are naturally lashing out against the brown tidal waves washing over our shores that they rightly see as the cause of crime, loss of jobs, and the death of our heritage. But there's even a more nefarious element skulking around among our folk that few recognize, and that is the con man, agent provocateur, who traffics among the pro-white groups with the singular goal of provoking weaker members into stupidity and criminal action, misdirected criminal action, or to discredit us from acting like the Klansmen mentioned above. Sure, there are plenty of less than intelligent followers who need no such provocation, but establishment con men act as one of us while putting the enemy's words in our mouth. And they are successful because the media lumps us all into the same basket, with the result that the ignorant sheeple believe all these idiots represent the rest of us. I suspect almost anyone newly awakened to racial consciousness has experienced adverse reactions from family and friends with comments along the lines of, quote, I'm well aware of what you people really believe, so don't you lie to me, unquote. But the truth is that these Pavlovian responses have been slowly and carefully trained into the masses by witnessing the moronic antics of Hollywood Nazis, Ku Klux Klan clowns, and pinheads in the movies and TV talk shows. over my long history among the so-called movements, I've witnessed many of these establishment con men at work. Some are actually paid government agents and informants. Others are directed by the media, such as undercover reporters, who want to stir the pot so that they can get a good story. Larry Flint once placed a reporter into the Aryan Nations back when I was active, and yet others are placed by foreign agencies and opposing movements such as the Zionists and the Israelis, Anti-Defamation League, Jewish Defense League, Anti-Racist Action, and the like. Most often these people seem completely sincere and credible. At other times they are obviously trying to stir up trouble and provoke stupidity among the folk. The difficulty comes in trying to distinguish the morons from the con men or agent provocateur. It may be true that an inexperienced idiot might be salvaged through education and experience, but sometimes it's better to send him packing along with potential system lackeys. If a knucklehead is genuinely sincere, he may learn from the experience and become a valued comrade in the future. I recall some examples of media manipulation in talk show settings. In one case, a young man we'd seen on other shows, one on body piercing and another topic, appeared portraying himself as a skinhead. He rattled off all sorts of hateful, racist BS stuff not even the more rabid among us would say, as he argued with the opposition on the show. Then in the next episode, he appeared broken and contrite, converted by the reasoning of the liberal race mixers, and meekly apologetic of his former racism. In another show, a similar ploy took place with a so-called Klan family that no one among the movement knew. The show featured an angry Klan mother. Then, a miracle of miracles, she repented of her racism on the next show and was so tearfully sorry for her racist behavior. These people are right out of central casting in Hollywood. Of course, there are no end to the number of race-trading former Klansmen, neo-Nazis, Aryan Nations, and others who have rolled over on their former convictions. The question is, were they actually one of us in the first place? No, I say they weren't. What is the biblical principle? If they left us, they were never of us. Back in those early years of the movements, the media tried many stunts. One was to avoid interviews and talk shows with experienced movement activists and seek only inexperienced newcomers who are unable to answer baited questions or articulate their feelings. I recall once when a talk show tried to pick on our women, gathering a number of gals from different pro-white groups to go on a show about movement women. We were wise enough to select sisters who had years of experience. They made us proud by turning the establishment's lies against it. The host thought he could pick on one young girl who had been raised among a racial family, and she really did us proud, very capable of countering all the common media questions designed to catch up on the inexperienced. But those were the old days, two or three decades ago, and the media is even more nefarious and crafty today. Even the youth of that time had a tentative connection to our past, but now our children are more lost than ever, having been raised to put Jewish materialism before everything else and to despise every aspect of their own heritage. Most of the young men I meet these days are truly twofold, more the children of hell than the Jews media that has raised them. My advice today is for everyone to avoid the media and never go on a talk show or do interviews. The establishment has the game and they've got all the rules in their favor. Only an experienced leadership should ever become involved in interviews. And even then, only short, to-the-point statements should be made. So-called free speech is a thing of the past, and only universalist perverts and race mixers have a voice in today's Jews media. David Tate, 2014, and that's very true, very true. Well, of course, those of us that have been at it for a while, we've known this for a long time. See, back when I was trying to work with organizations, it always turned out that way, that these people would come in, they'd be around for a few months, and then they'd be gone. Or they'd end up on a TV show saying how rotten we were and how sorry they were and what criminals we were and how many people we'd killed and everything else. That's why I went to the lone wolf process, leaderless resistance, because it was the only way of having any kind of security at all. Since I've moved in that direction in the last, 10 or 12 years, things have gone much smoother. We don't get all these infiltrators coming around trying to get in, because you can't get in to the situation the way I run it. You can communicate with me on the internet, or even communicate with me on a telephone, but you're not going to get in to my inner circle. You're not going to get in into my home or my office or anything like that. And so what are you going to do? Well, the last two that tried it failed, even though they were able to get an ATF raid on my house hoping they'd find something, which they didn't. And so it's been extremely difficult. They used to come up to you on the street or in a store or in a bar and say, "Oh, I agree with you. I like what you say. Can I come over and talk to you about it?" And pretty soon they'd want to be right next to you and know what you're thinking, what you're doing, everything else. And of course, I was always, maybe you say I was paranoid, but maybe paranoia, a certain amount of paranoia is very good, because I'm not in the prison. Been in jail a couple of times on trumped up deals, but never prison. So I must have done something right along the way. And so when I tell you something, you can pretty well take it to the bank. Anybody that's been at this very long, or maybe not hardly at all, easily can know who the enemy is. You don't have to read the Encyclopedia Britannica to know who the enemy is and who's hurting the white race. You can look all around you, your local politics, your state politics, or your national, federal politics, and see in a moment if you've got half a brain. And if you don't have a brain enough to figure out who these criminals are, these traitors, who at some point in our future must be dealt with, if you can't figure that out, well, you don't want to get involved in anything, I'll tell you that. Well, someone finally sent me a note, and I appreciate you sending me this note about Manfred Roeder, who was a very good friend of mine for years, from Germany. He was born in February 1929, and he died on the 30th of July this year. He was a lawyer, and he was a German soldier in World War II, and a prominent Holocaust investigator. And he was convicted and sent to prison for, I think it was about 8 or 9 years, maybe 10 years, because in Germany you don't have free speech or anything approaching free speech when it comes to our kind of politics. All you have to do over there is debate the Holocaust or something like that, or say, well, everything Hitler did wasn't bad, and off you go to jail as being an enemy of the Constitution. That's what they call it. They've got some really weird laws over there. And those kind of laws will gradually come here. We've got our hate laws and so forth. Well, I first came to know Manfred Roeder back in the early 70s, as I recall, because he came to the West Coast on a speaking trip. Some of the right-wingers were putting it on. I forget now who did host it. But anyhow, then he came back later, and I set up a big banquet for him at the at the Alpine House down in Torrance, California, who at that time was owned by a German who welcomed us with open arms to have any kind of meeting in there we wanted. And we also gave respect and for Bob Miles, who was doing 10 years in the federal pen at the same time Manfred visited us out there. So we put a special place at our banquet table for Bob Miles. And then he went back to Germany and continued. What got him in trouble to begin with, he lived in a small town and they had a porno theater. He got all upset about that and went in and poured paint all over the lobby, destroying the carpet and everything. That was his first rub with the law over there in Germany. Then later, he was imprisoned for, like I say, daring to question the number of Jews that were sacrificed by their brethren. And so then his wife came over here to the United States, and I hosted a meeting for her in Torrance, California, too. And she stayed, as I recall, she stayed at our house for a couple of days. But then after that, I sort of lost contact after a while. I've had a problem with revisionists. That I've always been friendly to revisionists and appreciate good historical revision, but it's sort of a cult situation of sometimes I call them pseudo intellectuals, and a lot of them are nice people and like that, but they. After Tom Metzger was in the streets and oddly enough winning the Democrat nomination for Congress, for some reason they began pulling away from me. And I had a problem with Willis Carto, who ran Liberty Lobby at the time, because he was having these revisionist meetings. And he kept being attacked by Irv Rubin of the Jewish Defense League, and there'd been other meetings attacked by the JDL and so forth. And I told these guys, I said, "Why? You got to have some defense here. You got to have defense on these things. You got to get killed." And so Willis Carto wanted me to furnish security for one of his big yearly meetings, and I said, "Yeah. You're going to pay these guys, and also you're going to have a fund ready and attorneys ready for anybody that's arrested to go to their aid." Because we'd had experience with Carto on another occasion with the National Socialists in L.A. who got in a jam, and he wouldn't come. He instigated them and then wouldn't come to their aid. So he said, "Oh, no, he couldn't do that. You got to do it for love of your race." Or love of something. And I said, "These guys are working guys. They got to go to work on Monday. They can't be in jail on Monday. They're willing to fight and maybe die, but you're going to have to show good faith and put up money for these guys." Willis Carto had plenty of money. There was no doubt about the money. So we told Willis and the boys to go fish. And that sort of, I think that put a bad taste in their mouth, too, that they couldn't use my men without guaranteeing them legal representation if they get arrested. So, anyhow, and then the same with Ernst Zundel. Who I had befriended, and we'd been friends for quite some time. I'd visited him and done TV shows with him in his studio, and he'd done shows with me down here in the United States and so forth. But there was a point there where somebody was working on these guys, because suddenly Oh, we don't want to be connected to that Metzger. It's pretty much so that we didn't play games. We didn't pull punches. We had to go in the street and kick ass. We did. And these guys want to intellectualize themselves into power or position. And I've told them over and over again, it wasn't the intellectuals who put Hitler in power. The intellectuals run for the trees when things get hot. It was thousands and millions of brown shirts that put Hitler into power. Don't kid yourself. And it took brown shirts willing to go out in the streets and kill or be killed that put him into power. Now, whether you agree with Hitler or part of what Hitler did or none of what Hitler did, I don't care. But he did achieve power, and he didn't get it by having intellectual cookie meetings and coffee and tea. And the same way with Mussolini, when his black shirts outnumbered 20 to 1, went against the communists and fought them out just like the old West in the middle of the street with gunfights. If you never read that book, Red Dragon and the Black Shirts, you need to read it. What a guy. They had the balls, I'll tell you that. And that's what it took. You're not going to take this thing back in some kind of intellectual debate. You're not going to take it back by just voting or voting period, because it's everything now could be manipulated to the point where it's ridiculous. So that's if you take that position, not that you're a crazy man and want to go out and just start indiscriminately using violence and conspiring to do nutty things that don't get you anywhere, but you have to face it. The way it's going now, in the end, it's going to be like the Alamo. I'm telling you. And all these people that sit around writing books and intellectualizing, you're wonderful. Come speak before my group. We'll pay you money, all that kind of stuff. Believe me, they'll be headed for the hills. You won't be able to find them once the crap really starts. So I guess that's maybe one of the reasons I'm not invited to the IHR conferences to speak. They don't want guys like me, working class street type guys, willing to go into the street. They don't want guys like that. And conversely, I don't want to waste my time talking to people like that, because they know what's going on. They know the enemy, who the enemy is, and so they spend thousands of dollars every year flying around the country to these meetings, telling each other what they've known for most of their lives. I mean, these guys have been in this thing for 30, 40 years, and they go to these confabs and pay money for hotel rooms and plane fare and all that. And what do? Talk about the same thing they talked about last year. I got better things to do with my money than that. Anyhow, no matter how it turned out, I'm sad to see Manfred Roeder pass away. He was a good man. He had a good heart, and he did what he thought was right. Well, here's something I want to comment on. Neo-Nazis from Sweden are in the Ukraine fighting for the cause of the pro-EU, U.S.-backed Kiev government. They're fighting with Azov Battalion, a Ukrainian squad that flies a flag with Nazi symbols, on which one Swedish soldier says fights for a white Ukraine. You see, this is how things get totally screwed up. These are not National Socialists. They may be neo-Nazis, but they're not National Socialists. And to make a ridiculous statement talking about a white Ukraine, what about a white Russia? A white Eastern Ukraine. There's plenty of white. There's a hell of a lot more white people in Russia and those areas than there are in the Ukraine. Ukraine was originally set up as a Jewish state way back. And it's got all kinds of Jewish control now. And here's these National Socialists, so to speak, going down there to fight on their side. American corporations and the corrupt leadership of the Kiev government and the EU. These guys need their head examined. If they get their head blown off down there, they're paid for, as far as I'm concerned. You can't fix stupid. The Azov Battalion is one of the Ukraine's many paramilitary groups formed in response to the government's struggle against pro-Russian separatists in the country's east. Many of the battalion members are, by their own description, ultra-right Ukrainian nationalists. That's why I don't like the right wing, according to an Al Jazeera report. And if they're national socialists, how can they be ultra-right? That don't even make any sense. The battalion has adopted symbols and slogans that come close to those used by neo-Nazis. What does that come close to shit? Drawing alarm from many moderate Ukrainians and fueling the fire of Russian media accusations that the current Kiev government is a fascist junta. No, it's just a corrupt junta, that's all. With American corporations and EU corporations pulling the strings behind this corrupt Kiev government to rob the damn Ukrainians from everything they've got. Now four neo-Nazis have joined the group. Sounds like some of the people that had tried to join up with me in the past that I told them to go on down the road. Mikhail Skilt is one of them. Quote, my goal is a white Ukraine. Oh, God, it's enough to make you sick. He told newspapers, Svetska Dagbladet, on July 23rd in a telephone interview made while he was with the Azov Battalion somewhere outside Donetsk, said, I'm a nationalist and I want there to still be a white Europeans in Europe. Well, then why don't you go back to goddamn Sweden and clean out the niggers in Sweden, you idiot? Quote, we're finding and grabbing people who collaborated with the separatists. Asked how he communicated with the locals, he replied, I often have an interpreter. I understand some Russian, but I do not speak the language. I can only say commands like stay, down on your knees, hands behind your head. Oh. This is like the National Socialists that I uncovered, they're not National Socialists, the Nazis that I uncovered back in the 80s that were set up by the CIA. And they were being sent over to Africa to disrupt Liberia. And they were paid every step of the way by the CIA. Luckily, they got arrested in South America before they could get their ship all laid out to go over there and try to overthrow the government. But all of a sudden, their jail cells were open one night, and they were allowed to escape. They came back. I knew them. They tried to get back into my sphere of influence, and I sent them on down the road. CIA pay people like this to do this kind of shit. And some of them are so stupid, they really think they're doing a good thing. And I'll bet you another thing, there's quite a bit of money pouring in there for some of these yahoos to go down there from the idiots in the right wing in this country. You know who they are, too. We got quite a number of them around, and they're still into the old right-wing bullshit, and they'll be first to jump into this like they do every right-wing fiasco that goes on in Europe. They put money into it. It's a waste of time, and it's counterproductive. It's suicide to support right-wing activity over there. These kind of people will be used as long as there's some value to the powers that be, and then they'll have them shot or throw them aside like a rag doll. If you know any young person that's thinking of going over there and fighting on the side of the EU, which makes me sick, try to talk them out of it, maybe even break their legs. I'll bet you a lot of Jews are out too, how stupid these Jews are going over here from the United States to fight for the IDF in Israel. They're insane. And now you got some of these children of recent immigrants from Islam countries here in this country that are going back over there to fight on the side of Islamists. It's all insane. take care of your problem at home, like these Swedish National Socialists, Sweden sliding into the garbage pit with niggers all over coming in from North Africa, and they're going down to EU to keep the Ukraine, to keep the Ukraine white. It's enough to drive you crazy listening to this stuff. I've run into guys like this before that were in the military. These guys just want to get a gun. They want to be able to shoot people. Pure and simple. They want to kill people. I'll guarantee you, percentage-wise, Russia is far whiter than Ukraine.
Welcome to the Potter Blog site, April 11th, 2014. Based on testimony in front of the United States Congress on April 8th, the Department of Defense has issued these JB-AIDS biowarfare hemorrhagic fever detectors, Ebola detectors, if you will, to National Guard units in all 50 states. So pay very close attention if you see this unit in use in the field somewhere, in a clinic or a hospital. This is an extreme early warning indicator that something significant and serious is occurring. So let's give you some of the details here on what we know. Basically, I'll show you the link. This is the document from the House of Representatives. It's from it's a statement by Carmen J. Spencer, Joint Program Executive Officer for Chemical and Biological Defense. The House Armed Services Committee, Subcommittee on Intelligence and Emerging Threats and Capabilities on April 8th, 2014. We have a link to this, all the pages in it. Basically, we excerpt some key statements. Basically, it says here, collaboration between the U.S. Army and FDA, facilitated the availability of viral hemorrhagic fever diagnostic assays for use during a declared emergency and as previously unavailable preparedness activity to this fielded system. That goes on to display later how it's fielded. For a near-term capability to combat emerging threat materials, we have already provided domestic response capability kits to National Guard weapons of mass destruction, civil support teams resident in all 50 states. These kits provide emerging threat mitigation capability that includes detection, personnel, protection, and decontamination. Now, it is unclear how real or imminent the threat may be, but it is clear that there's been a massive surge of governmental spending and preparedness which has occurred since hemorrhagic H7N9 bird flu came on the scene in 2013, and that those preparedness activities are accelerating as Ebola has started to gain momentum in Africa. And we have multiple links about that in our source links below. Now, there are multiple vignettes one could put forth for these activities, governmental activities, ranging from simple, wasteful governmental defense spending, medical spending, to an airborne mutated Ebola, or it could be that they're expecting a biological first strike in prelude to World War III. The preparation seemed lean towards the latter. You know, it'd be easy to cover up some of these biological first strikes in what's happening in the world right now biologically. But rather than worry about the situation, course of action is to be aware of the unusual military equipment which would be utilized in a defense situation. As such information will provide leading edge risk mitigation, actionable information to threats that may result in mass panic or mass quarantine. Now that's the key, is if you spot some of these materials or equipment in use, that's your sign that something serious is wrong or is going wrong, and that you should expect significant activity to take place, governmental actions to take place in the very short term. And having that information before can provide you with some capability to make immediate preparations or take risk mitigation actions. Now, pay special attention to this JBAIDS device. This is the Joint Biological Agent Identification and Diagnostic System. This is what it looks like. This is the device here. The key thing to note is this vent system here, this cover. If you see this sitting in a clinic somewhere, you know, a healthcare clinic, urgent care center, or a hospital, this is stuff only carried by the military, and it's for use in these very specific situations. So if you see this in use, then you know something is significantly wrong, because this is not equipment that one would expect to find normally in a hospital. Now, that equipment is carried often in one of the two vehicles I'm going to show you. This is a Humvee Joint Biological Point Detection System. The key things to notice are the air samplers on top here. So this is the type of Humvee one would expect would be driving around an area where they're trying to detect the source of something. There's another version here too, and again you can spot the this one's typically, I believe, used more for chemical warfare, but it also does biological detections. Again, you spot the vents or the air samplers above. So if you see one of these two things driving around your neighborhood, something's up biologically. If you see this device in use, there's serious trouble afoot. And again, we have all the source documents here. You should read through these, because it's amazing what the government is prepping for right now. Just utterly amazing.
Well, this is how insane Washington has gotten to be. A U.S. aid worker who was infected with the deadly Ebola virus. Now remember, 90% fatality with Ebola. While working in West Africa, will be flown to the United States to be treated in a high security ward at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, a hospital official said on Thursday. I sent you out some more information on this on an alert. The aid worker, whose name has not been released, will be moved in the next several days to a special isolation unit at Emory. The unit was set up in collaboration with the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. This patient should have been kept isolated in Africa. This is how insane the people who are supposed to be protecting the public in this country are, to bring that biological bomb. I guess it's been about 3 years ago now that a contingent of the ARA that allegedly spawned right here in Indiana, where I'm from, or where I'm at, invaded a coffee shop over in Illinois to a bunch of right-wingers who were European heritage people who never have security. They never have security. Mostly older people in the whole bit. And these ARA guys came in, they're pistol-whipped and beat up, hospitalized several white senior citizens that were into this, quietly having this meeting. And of course, I preach to these people over and over and over for years. You have to be prepared for this kind of stuff. You have to have guards. You have to have people silently sitting at other tables and a whole bit, and take care of these people when they attack you. We preached and preached and preached in California, but the right wing still would not listen to us. And so they would get invaded, they'd get beat up and everything else, because they didn't want to be associated with us unwashed white racists. Pure and simple. Oh, that might be offensive to somebody that we saved your ass and beat the crap out of your enemies. Listen to this. This is the recording. I sent the video out to you today, but this is the recording, and this is what makes you sick when all it takes is a few young guys to stake out these places and make sure this kind of stuff doesn't happen, because you can't depend on the cops. It's all over before the cops get there, even if the cops want to do something. They arrested the guys and they charged them with felonies, but the point is, they've already done the physical damage of putting people in the hospital.
Oh, my God, I don't know. Somebody just came through here. Oh, my God, hurry up. Hurry up. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Hurry.
On May 19th, 2012, 18 members of something called the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement stormed the Ashford House restaurant in Tinley Park, Illinois, armed with hammers and clubs. They attacked a small gathering of a group called the Illinois European Heritage Association. What follow are never-before-released footage of the attack and recordings from emergency services and police radio.
Like literally like 15 kids, they had handkerchiefs over their face and were wearing black hoods, and they came in and they said, "What's up, motherfucker bitch?" And then they like took a chair and then like threw it at a guy.
Is anybody hurt there?
Yes.
There are people hurt?
Yes.
Okay, we're gonna get an ambulance over there as well. Hold on a second.
Oh my God, dude, are you bleeding?
Okay, we got ambulances coming. How many people are hurt? Can you tell me how many people are hurt?
I don't know. There's like several people that are hurt.
911.
You need to get cops over to Ashford House on 159th Street quickly. There was a group that just came in here and started everybody up.
They did
please, quickly, and I think we might
have
been
able to. What did they do?
They came in with started beating the place up with chairs, and they're hitting everybody over the head.
Are they still there?
No, they ran out in the parking lot, but you need to get the police over here.
Right.
Tinley Park 911. This is Ashford House Restaurant. There's people beating you up in our store right now.
What?
I need a paramedic.
What are they doing?
They're destroying my restaurant at the moment. They're beating the shit out of each other. I got guys bleeding everywhere.
We need about a half dozen ambulances up here.
Tinley Park, please. We have officers and ambulances on the way. Can you tell me anything that happened?
Well, we were sitting in there and just made an order, and there was a group of fellows in there sitting at a table. They weren't bothering anybody. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people came in. They were dressed in black, and they started picking up chairs, and they started hitting everybody over the head. We got so scared.
Okay.
And
do you know which way they left?
They went in a red Dodge Neon. They headed going east down 159th Street in a red Dodge Neon.
Witnesses said the attackers chanted political slogans in the parking lot before bursting into the restaurant, where they shouted, "Hey bitches, the ARA is going to fuck up this place." ARA stands for Anti-Racist Action. The perps then began upending tables and smashing and throwing plates. They injured 10 diners, 4 of whom needed stitches, and 3 were hospitalized. They did not limit their attack to the table of about 10 supposed racists. Restaurant owner Mike Winston noted that, quote, "Once they attacked the table, they went and started hitting random people. The owner chased one of the attackers out the back door and tackled him before 5 others got out of a getaway car and, quote, started kicking the crap out of me." The Chicago Sun-Times said the perps, quote, did not discriminate as to the targets of their violence, even pushing an 80-year-old woman to the ground. Several dozen women having a bridal shower were horrified by the mob attack, and a graduation party was ruined. When the graduate's father picked up a chair to protect his family, an anti-racist hit him in the head with a baton. Minutes after the attack, an off-duty police officer pulled over the Dodge Neon and arrested 5 of the perps. Police found police-style batons and a knife in the car. Alex Stuck, brothers Cody, Dylan, and Jason Sutherland, and their cousin John Tucker were arrested and charged with felony mob action, aggravated battery, and criminal damage to property. On January 4, 2013, the 5 each pled guilty to 3 felony counts of armed violence. Jason Sutherland was sentenced to 6 years in prison. Cody and Dylan Sutherland got 5 years. Alex Stuck and John Tucker received 3.5 years. These men's supporters refer to them as the Tinley Park 5. 7 months later, and over a year after the attack, police arrested Jason Hammond for his involvement in the assaults, charging him with armed violence, aggravated battery, and mob action. Mr. Hammond is out on bail, awaiting an August 1st court date. In 2009, he was arrested for a similar attack, when he and 7 others tried to disrupt a group gathered to hear David Irving, a historian accused of minimizing the Holocaust, only to find police waiting for them. Mr. Hammond pled guilty to disorderly conduct and got off with 10 days of community service and a small fine. Police have not revealed how they caught Mr. Hammond this time, but surveillance footage we obtained from the police shows several of the perps eating at a Five Guys restaurant prior to the attack. Minutes after the first group entered the restaurant, a second group joined them. The white man, here with the ear gauges and neck tattoos, appears to be Alex Stuck. This appears to be Jason Hammond. Here he is winding up to smash something, or someone, in the Ashford House video. Jason and Cody Sutherland are also clearly identifiable in the Five Guys footage. All of these men were brought to justice. But what about their friends? The white man here is wearing the same shorts and shoes as this baton-wielding attacker in the Ashford video. The black man has the same hat, shirt, shorts, and arm tattoos as this masked, baton-wielding thug. Why haven't they been arrested? Why haven't their friends been arrested? The faces of many of them are clear in the Five Guys footage. Why haven't police made these images public? We tried to find out from the Tinley Park Police, but repeated phone calls over the course of several weeks were not returned. Both Alex Stuck and John Tucker were released after serving just 18 and 20 months, respectively, of their 42-month sentences. Other members of the Tinley Park Five may be released before year's end. All of their lawyers worked pro bono. John Tucker's lawyer, Stuart Smith, said, quote, "I was honored to represent this man. He is a hero." He says the attackers stormed the restaurant because, quote, "they were trying to fight for equal rights." 12 of the attackers have still not been brought to justice.
Well, what do you expect? The system cops to do your work for you? You think they give a shit? They got to save face, so they, you know, they got a few that were right out there in the open. But where are these guys at? Look, if you hear of any ARA meetings or anything going on with the ARA or any group like that in the Midwest, let me know. I want to know about it. I want to know who their attorneys are, too. We're going to keep a little eye on these boys. Now, these are mostly what we would call stick skins back in the old days. These are little shrimpy guys with no muscle hardly at all, out there beating up on old ladies. So the American Renaissance put this out. I don't have much use for their leadership either. But anyhow, the point is, we need intelligence information. And if anybody like this revisionist or Renaissance people are having a meeting someplace, let us know, because that'll attract this ARA, and the secret is they won't even know we're going to be around, and we'll take care of business. Okay? Get the information. And that American Renaissance is run by Jared Taylor, who is a limp-wristed, pro-white kind of guy and condemns all this interracial violence. Of course, he knows there's going to be interracial violence. There's always going to be interracial violence until there's only one race left in this particular continent. So, you know, these kind of guys, they go around, they give speeches and all that kind of stuff, but at least they made a little video of this deal in Tinley Park, Illinois. But for the most part, they're worthless as tits on a boar hog.
again from the beautiful Aragon Ballroom on Lick Pier at the beautiful Santa Monica Beach, California. We've been getting lots of cards and letters from you folks out there in the television land. And we surely do thank you for all the cards and the letters from you folks out there in the television land. Starting us off tonight is our trio, the Lemon Sisters. And girls, what are you going to sing?
We're going to sing thank you for all those cards and letters you folks out there in television land.
Lent.
Lent.
And after appropriate the number, one and two and...
Thank you for all those cards and letters.
No, I haven't gone nuts. I was playing back, trying to find a Stan Freberg thing on the Lawrence Welk show, talking about the bubble and the bubble machine he used to have out in Santa Monica at his big dance hall. And the reason I'm putting that on is because we're going to go into the financial bubble time here. We're big time financial bubble. Here we go. Take it away. My favorite financial guy on Friday here, Max Kaiser. Take it away, Max.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know Euripides once wrote, when one with honeyed words but evil mind persuades the mob, great woes befall the state. Oh, woe is me and you and us, for with honeyed central banking words the mob has been persuaded to buy with borrowed money. Well, great woes befall the state of the economy. Stacy.
Well, Max, in the United States, here's an article republished in USA Today. Is the Fed fueling a giant stock market bubble? And they invite you to take a look at this S&P chart from 1996 to present, and you'll see the internet bubble, then the housing bubble, and then today they have exclamation point question mark and say that you'd be excused for concluding that we're in the midst of the greatest stock market bubble of all time, because the prices today on the S&P 500 are 30% higher than either those other two.
Well, as a student of bubbles, going back to, I just recently learned that my mentor on Wall Street, Jeffrey J. Winters, has passed away, who was a great Wall Street broker of his day. We would chat often of the history of bubbles at the New York Stock Exchange Luncheon Club. We used to go there. And he would give me the history of Wall Street. And each bubble has its own unique characteristics. Now, the stock market bubble of 1987 that I was a witness was driven by what was called portfolio insurance. The dot-com mania of the 1990s, which I was also a witness and participating in Los Angeles, California, this was driven by IPO laddering. Frank Quattroni over at Credit Suisse and Henry Blodgett over there and wherever he was working, and Mary Meeker, they created this extraordinary tech.com bubble that was driven by delusions. Then you had the subprime collapse, which was driven by sucking in a lot of pension money and institutional money into what was essentially absolutely unsellable, unconscionable garbage. This bubble, this epic 2014 bubble, you could call it the sovereign bond bubble, with Spanish bonds trading at all-time highs, with British gilts or sovereigns trading at 300-year highs, with American sovereign debt trading near 240-year highs. This is a bubble driven by central banks, a coordinated effort by central banks. Mario Draghi at the time over there at ECB is the guy who's buying those Spanish bonds, buying those European sovereign bonds, increasing the balance sheet of the central bank in Europe to equal the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England, where they're taking on trillions of dollars, euros, yen, of course, Bank of Tokyo being the granddaddy of all this, in toxic debt, to the point where this, too, will reach its point of no return, and there'll be a massive sovereign debt bubble, the likes of which the world has never known before. I think the ECB's asset purchases will bring us to the end of this bubble phase in the relative short order.
Well, USA Today, on this article, even though they present it with those charts and they with the misleading title of, is the Fed fueling a giant stock market bubble, they say, no, no, no. While the fact that the Fed's monetary policies have caused stock prices to soar, it doesn't mean there's a bubble. They say that. In fact, the reason for this is simple. In order for there to be a bubble, asset prices must be more than inflated. They must be irrationally inflated. And though, like I've discussed, this isn't the case. If anything, in fact, the increase in asset prices is entirely rational. And what does he use as his argument to prove that they're not irrational? Well, he uses Noah Smith writing in Bloomberg, says that the 0% rates justify these stock market valuations because the value of a financial asset is the discounted present value of its future payoff, and when the discount rate, of which the Fed interest rate is a component, goes down, the true fundamental value of risky assets goes up mechanically and automatically. That's rational price appreciation, not a bubble.
Well, before every crash, there are journalists who famously go on record predicting that there won't be a crash. In the 1929 crash, we had a lot of famous quotes from those calling about stock markets hitting a permanently high plateau. The same thing in the 1987 crash, right before it crashed, you had a lot of writers coming out and saying the markets were about ready to double or triple in value. The dot-com crisis, Alan Greenspan himself thought that the economy had entered a new era of permanent prosperity with 4% GDP or higher possible given this new technological invention, the Internet. And, of course, then you had an 85% drop in the NASDAQ. So here we are, 2014. We're getting ready for the 2014 sovereign debt bubble, which will be the biggest bubble collapse in history. And, of course, there are going to be writers that will quote in a year's time or 2 years' time who famously made the boneheaded comments that the last guy to make the stupidest comment possible before the lemmings all went off the cliff.
In fact, he reminds me, because he mentions mechanical and automatic, he reminds me of these robots that the South Korean team, the Hanwha Eagles, have placed in their audience, in their auditorium at their baseball games, that they've lost 400 games in a row. Okay, now they have these robots, and I'll show you this image here. This is the robots. These are fans that are like, woohoo! It's no matter how bad the team's doing, they're up there cheering, just like this guy is like. There's always a mechanical robot, usually an academic or a journalist, there to tell you why these markets can only go higher.
But let's continue with this metaphor, because beneath the surface, if you look at corporate America, they're losing money hand over fist. This is being disguised by the fact that they're borrowing money at these 0% interest rates to buy back their own stock, thus depleting the number of shares outstanding and artificially pumping up those earnings per share numbers and the P.E. ratio, which says it's, you know, 16, 17, 18 times, which is on the high end. If you discount for all the stock that's been bought back, it's probably trading closer to 30 or 40 times P.E., which, of course, is off the charts very high. Accounting fraud has masked this bubble. Central bank participation and manipulation has masked this bubble. The wholesale manipulation in the precious metals markets has masked this bubble. The collusion in the central banking world around the world is the Bank of International Settlements itself. The one bank with the sharpest eye on what's going on around the world just came out last week and said these markets are in a bubble. So the fact that some yahoo down in Nowheresville is speaking out of his shring-shring about what he sees as some very narrow focus on data that was spoon-fed to him by one of those waving mechanical puppets in a stadium somewhere means nothing.
Now, there is a former academic who became a money manager, and that's John Hussman, and he's written this about these markets that some, like the USA Today article, are saying are not overvalued. He's saying, yes, this is an equity bubble. And he does all these fancy math to prove that it's, in fact, overvalued. But he calls it what investors are doing. My sense is that investors have indeed abandoned basic arithmetic here and are instead engaging in a sort of loose thinking called hyperbolic discounting, the willingness to impatiently accept very small payoffs today in preference to larger rewards that could otherwise be obtained by being patient. In effect, zero interest rates have made investors willing to accept any risk, no matter how extreme, in order to avoid the discomfort of getting nothing in the moment.
What would happen if the casino in Las Vegas suddenly charged zero for the chips that you went to the casino with? Okay, what would happen? Would you see more or less gambling in the casino if chips were free? Okay, so the central bank, by making interest rates zero for a very select privileged class of speculators in America and around the world, they've reduced the price of chips to zero. And they pull on the America's dang-dong, and they pull America's dang-dong all day long. And it's not quite this action, but they pull on the one-armed bandit of American economy. And occasionally they reap a huge windfall. If they run out of free chips, the central bank gives them more free chips. Meanwhile, everyone else has got a job sweeping up the vomit in the bathroom from all these speculators burping up and coughing up, you know, and vomiting up all the free booze. That's also included with all the free chips. So, you know, that's not an economy I can believe in. That's no economy of janitors and vomiting speculators at the Gulag Casino with free chips and booze from the central banks. Of course it's going to end in tears. Of course it's going to end in one big vomitorium of risk suddenly disgorged like a bulimic at a cotillion.
Well, John Hussman then goes on to discuss further these central banks giving away the free chips. Essentially, he's saying that all that said, the simple fact is that the primary driver of the markets here is not valuation or even fundamentals, but perception. The perception is that somehow the Federal Reserve has the power to keep the stock market in suspended and even diagonally advancing animation, and that zero interest rates offer no choice but to hold equities.
Right, just advancing animation like a freaking Donald Duck cartoon. It's animation like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff. He's still running. Until he looks down, and the Roadrunner's out there. You know, markets go up the staircase of hope, and they crash down the elevator shaft of reality into the puddle of your own vomit and urine because some idiot on Bloomberg decided to write some stupid, mechanical, puffed-up, nonsensical piece about why markets are cheap. Yeah, they're cheap, all right, buddy. You can carry you out in a stretcher and see how cheap that is.
So he then continues on that theme of what the central banks have done, and he says, what's actually true is that the Fed has now created $4 trillion of idle currency and bank reserves that must be held by someone, and because investors perceive risky assets as having no risk, they have been willing to hold them in search of any near-term return greater than zero. What is actually true is that even an additional year of zero interest rates beyond present expectations would only be worth a roughly 4% bump to market valuations. And he says, essentially, not as in sort of fancy words as you, but that we're going to fall down that elevator shaft because of this.
Here's what I see happening. These low interest rates, this is what the top 1% of the top 1% are banking on. They want to take the entire world private. They want to take every stock in the S&P, and they want to privatize it all. And the central banks are giving them the ability to do so at 0% interest rates. IBM is going to go private. Coca-Cola is going to go private. Every Dow Jones component is going to go private. They're going to take it all private. I think that's the master plan, is to remove public ownership or stock market participation from the unwashed masses who have the temerity to go out there and buy a share in some publicly listed company hoping that they too can emulate Warren Buffett. All that's going to be wiped out by the Koch brothers, the Buffetts of the world, the private equity scam artists. They're going to take it all private. And that's what it's going to become. We're talking about oligarchy. You know, America's a kleptocracy oligarchy.
Well, finally, he says here that if this price today is fairly priced, as the USA Today article says, interest rates would need to stay zero until 2040. That is the only way they're fairly priced.
Yeah, okay, well, go long vomit futures, because it's a long way to fill the Grand Canyon with pure, unadulterated spew. Stacey, you've got to go.
Thank you, Max.
All right, stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more.
Well, thank you, Max. Great show. Come on back next Friday, Freya's Day. I'm telling you put it out there on these bastards. Goddamn corrupt banking system. And these guys, I'm telling you, a lot of our guys, we're upset about black crime, but I'll tell you, the biggest crime in the world is at the top. and get your guillotine blades sharpened, baby. Time is coming. Our time is coming. And we're going to close out now with one of our uplifting and cheery songs. Yeah. In the meantime, 14-5 and keep your mouth shut. Shut up. Keep it cool. Keep your powder dry. Worse is better for now.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death is the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your seat, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh, but death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh